The Senate Finance Committee will reconvene from our morning session. It is still May 11th. And it seems like there's been a lot of time in between. We will be taking up Senate File 1199, Senator Peterson, on the prevailing wage issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm grateful for the opportunity to come and talk with you about this issue. It can be divisive, but I think we have a real compromise. I think it's a significant change and move towards the middle from some of the other bills that have been presented in the Senate this session. If I could just ask for some guidance from the chair a little bit before we get started. I'm not sure how much background you want me to go into it relating to, you know, there's primarily two sections of the bill. One with relating to how the wage rate is calculated, and then one that changes overtime requirement. But I am certainly prepared just to focus on the fiscal note as well, if that's what you would prefer me to do. So,
well, Senator Peterson, we will focus on the fiscal note, but we do need a quick review of the entire bill because we have to vote the whole bill out. So we'd like our members to know what it contains.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Madam Chair and members. This bill really relates, there's two sections. The way prevailing wage is calculated right now, it's called the MODE, and that's when employers will complete a survey from the Department of Labor and Industry and send in the wage rates that they pay. MODE means that they will take the highest number of the dollar amount wage that they receive. That's what it currently is now, and we want to change it to the mean, which would be the average of all wages that are sent in, and use that as the prevailing wage rate. The second part is relates specifically to overtime work week. Currently right now, Minnesota law, prevailing wage law, requires that after 8 hours on an individual day, overtime is required. We'd like to change that so it's a 40-hour week. In my view, or our view, it would give the workers and the employer both a little more flexibility when workers work farther away from home to get a 10-hour day in and have a 4-day week and that type of thing. Those are kind of the main two points of the bill in that regard. And I can move into the fiscal note.
We may proceed with that. Sure. If you want to explain it or if you want our Senate fiscal analyst to explain it.
You can go ahead, and then I have comments and concerns about it that I hope the committee will consider.
Madam Chair, members, the fiscal note in your packet has been prepared by a number of agencies responded to the request on the fiscal note. The only actual fiscal impacts that are noted are for the Department of Labor and Industry, which is the first few pages of the fiscal note. And in it, they note a series of costs associated with the change that Senator Peterson described in the calculation methodology, and some of this is computer programming and or reprogramming, I should say. Rulemaking costs are about half of it, and then those costs are mitigated by a reduction in staff time toward the survey. The bill changes, or I believe Senator Peterson may have an amendment that Labor and Industry took into consideration that is reflected in the fiscal note that reduces the cycle from once every 12 months to every 24 months, and that would reflect in a reduction in staff time. So if that doesn't go in the bill, then that wouldn't be there as an offset. But the first year costs are the associated with the recalculation, the computer programming, rulemaking costs, and then if there are changes to the bill that I think Labor and Industry was anticipating, they've noted the offset due to the change in the survey cycle. The other agencies that responded to the fiscal note are those state agencies typically involved with major construction projects, transportation, University of Minnesota, Department of Admin, for example, a number of others. None of those departments noted a bookable or trackable fiscal impact. To varying degrees, they discussed impacts. But I think the general conclusion of generalized for all of them, I'll let you read the detail, is that It's essentially indeterminate at this point what impact it might have. It will certainly have an impact in how projects are bid, but it's indeterminate whether there will be a net cost, a net savings on future construction projects that might be let under a different set of prevailing wage laws.
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm not, at this point, I won't be offering that amendment. I feel like I got documentation that more than covers this fiscal note. There's a couple things that I would like to draw committee members' attention to under the assumptions in the second paragraph, where you can see it says, however, the second sentence, it is assumed that the use of the mean would result in additional challenges. And that's really my question, why, where those challenges come from. And if you decide to hear from the Department of Labor and Industry, they may be able to address that as well. But in my view, those challenges are people that participate in the system that they don't think it's fair for some reason. And really what happens, in my opinion, there is if somebody challenges the rate, they come on in and they sit down and they look at the documentation with the Department of Labor staff and they decide. And so I really question that assumption in regard to that sentence, because I'm not sure why this would create more challenges unless folks were intentionally creating challenges for some other purpose, because the mean is simply the average of all wages reported. You simply total up the wages that are reported, and you divide by the number that have come in, and that's the average. And so I really question the difficulty and why there would be significant amount of challenges there relating to that $28,000 that's added. You also note on the fiscal note that our nonpartisan fiscal staff did make requests to the U of M, MinSCU, the Department of Administration, the DOT, the DNR, and public facilities, and they all came back with the same answer. They are unable to evaluate this on a construction project. Well, so basically what I did is I did that myself. I have a handout here that if I could get distributed. So you'll see on this revised fiscal note, it was $88,000. The previous fiscal note, I guess I don't remember what that was, but it was a little bit higher. It was still under $100,000 without the change in the survey. And like I said, we won't be offering that amendment today at this point. But what this handout I have coming out to you is actually an evaluation of a project that's going on right now. It's the St. Cloud Civic Center. It's a project that has received state bonding dollars for planning and for demolition. And so the project was started, and then there's a bonding bill proposal right now, if there is one, that would ask for the rest of the money. But the project started because the residents of St. Cloud decided to start the project on their own with half of the money that they had raised already. And so the first sheet just documents the project. The second sheet just documents the scope of the work that we did for the comparison. That's just the concrete package. This is about a $7 to $8 million project right now. This concrete package is about an $800,000 bid. So pages 2 and 3 just document that, and then pages 4 and 5 relate specifically to the contractor, one of the contractors that bid this project. You can see on page 4. Is that that's his summary of his bid sheet, and you can see the total of that portion of that bid. Again, like I said, this is a project between $7 and $8 million. This concrete package, when it was bid with the prevailing wages, was about $850,000. And then the last page actually shows what he would have bid it at, or what his numbers would have been if he could have bid it at his merit pay wages, so the guys that work for him every day. And you can see that bid, same bid on this $800,000 project comes in at $704,000. And so, and this is a real world of example of a project that's going on right now that would have saved the taxpayers in the city of St. Cloud and the residents of Minnesota $150,000 on this one small part of this bid. And so if you do the math on that, so that's a 17% savings. Now, I'm not here to say that that's going to be the savings on every single project that the state of Minnesota decides to build. But so what if that savings is 5%? What if I'm wrong at the 17% and that savings is 5% or even 2% or 1% on a $500 billion bonding bill, or what we've seen proposed in the past, nearly a billion-dollar bonding bill? You can see with just very conservative estimates of just 1, 2, or 3%, or maybe even 5% savings. Again, this example shows you 17% savings, that the significant amount of money. And the reason why I'm carrying this bill, because what this would free up more dollars for more construction projects and get more people back to work. That's really the underlying theme or underlying purpose of carrying this bill forward, is to spread out those construction dollars, put more people back to work. And I'm sure you'll hear testimony in regard to that issue as well. Madam Chair, I do have a couple other folks that were interested in testifying in favor of this as well, if you would allow them to come forward at this point.
Senator Peterson, we will, but I just want to give them a heads up that we are planning to limit the time on each side so that it doesn't get too imbalanced, and so we could allow up to 15 minutes for each side, perhaps, and we do have several testifiers on each side. So if you want to bring up maybe two of yours at a time,
Madam Chair, Phil Raines, okay.
And Colleen Donovan and Cecilia Vitale.
Madam Chair.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While they're coming up, I'm just somewhat really interested in the assumptions page on this fiscal note. And I don't know if there's somebody that can give some response to just a couple of things, Madam Chair, that I'm going to throw towards your way. I find it real interesting that this bill would require such huge modifications to a computer program to the tune of $14,000 at $116 an hour. That's the assumption that they're saying that this is going to require. And I'm going, I find that very hard to believe, that there would have to be that kind of modification. I mean, I look at my own business, and we just redid our whole PC, and with the terminals that we have and the amount of people that we have going through and the amount of different prices that we have, and it was less than $1,000. So I'm really starting to look at some of these numbers that are being tossed around here, and I'm challenging what we're getting presented to us.
Excuse me.
Because it just doesn't make sense. I don't know if anybody can at some point maybe. And another one where they say the estimated cost for rulemaking is $44,000. We just believe that? I mean, there's nothing to back this up. And so it just looks like somebody might not want something to happen here. I don't know. I'm just looking for some answers at some point in time, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Perry. And perhaps if someone from Labor and Industry is here, we can have them try and address that issue after we get done with the testifiers who are for and against.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Perry. If I could address that, I mean, I share some same concerns, and that's why, you know, I had a few days yet before this hearing, and that's why I believe I presented an example to the members on this committee that shows that just with just this one job, this one little job in St. Cloud, because the Department of Labor is not able to book savings from other departments, which is understandable. But on this just one example I gave you, you could pay for this fiscal note. And, of course, we all know the number of jobs that are in a in a bonding bill, and the savings would be significant. So I'd like to introduce Ms. Donovan from Rockville, Minnesota.
Ms. Donovan, please identify yourself for the tape.
Yes, I am Colleen Donovan. I'm vice president of J.D. Donovan out of Rockville, Minnesota. And our company is in the trucking business, and we are in favor of this bill. In talking with our employees, we're a small business. They're in favor of it also because we have to go where the work is, and so they're, you know, three hours from home, and they're working, you know, 5/8 instead of 4/10 and getting a three-day week. So it's costing them more money to be away. The overtime over 40 instead of over 8 would also work, as right now a majority of the Minnesota contractors were working in Iowa and Minnesota and all over. And I've sent most of our people to Iowa because of the over 8. You know, you can't work 3 days and work 10 hours, and they, you know, you're paying 6 hours of overtime. So it doesn't work out for the employer or the employee. They're losing out. And from the mode to the mean, I am so much in favor of that because as a small company, it doesn't even pay for us to send in the surveys, and I get the surveys every year from the department. Right now they're surveying from April through. They've got to be in June 3rd, and yet it'll be 5-6 months down the road before they even come out with the survey. It'll be like the end of November before they come out with the new rates. And on the new rates, we'll also have rates for 5 months down the road or 6 months down the road because they're including what the increase in the union scale will be. But they're taking a company that's got 20 trucks compared to my 5. So I'm never going to get counted, so it's like I don't want to waste my time on the computer to put in the survey or put postage on the stamp, you know, and send it in. So I'm really hoping that you pass this bill because I think it will help a lot of small businesses.
Thank you, Ms. Donovan. Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Donovan is, you know, and I've heard this from other companies. How prevalent do you think this is? If the situation, if you're not willing to, if you don't want to take the time to report in, how much of this is going on around the state? Are small businesses just not taking the time to do this? Or
well, we won't be counted. Excuse me, Madam Chair. You take somebody out there like Schaefer Contracting who owns 40, 50 trucks, and I've got my 5. Who are they going to use? It's no different than up in the St. Cloud around the Region 5. Schaefer came up and did a big job up on Highway 10. Well, the normal scale in our area to live in Stearns County has changed because Schaefer was up there and reported the wages. So it changes where it's a big draw when the metro contractors come out into the rural areas.
Thank you. Our next testifier, please.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. My name is Phil Raines. I'm Vice President of Public Affairs for Associated Builders and Contractors, and we represent about 350 contractors throughout Minnesota and North Dakota. We've been looking at this issue for years and years and years. Basically, in the 38 years that we've seen this law put in place, it's ratcheted tighter and tighter and tighter every year, making things harder for contractors to actually work on these jobs, increasing the burdens on them for reporting, et cetera. And we're very excited to see a moderate piece of legislation out here that would make this better. We had the Minnesota Taxpayers Association do a study, looked at going from from the mode to an average. Basically, the mode is set up to find basically the highest rate. It actually has rules in that if you find a tie, you get the highest rates. It's the most frequently occurring number. And we looked at that and went, how can we have a law that makes so little sense as this? You know, this is basically a minimum wage law for construction on public jobs. And when you set a minimum wage law, you don't go out there and you look for the highest rates you can find. I mean, that's not the way you set a minimum wage. What the bill asks for is simply to go with the mean, the weighted average, and set that as the minimum. And by doing so, the MTA study came back and said it'll save us about 7.5% to 10% on our projects. Senator Peterson had a great example, and oh, he's a contractor and deals with this. My contractors, when I call them, ask them what's the premium that you put on prevailing wage jobs, and they tell me it's approximately 22% is what they put on a job. That's just the premium they add on top. It's the same workers doing the same work, building the same building. The specs are the specs, inspections. You have to put out a performance bond to guarantee the work that you do. You have to have licensed people to do it. You get the same building at the end of it. The question is, are we paying the highest rates we can, or are we trying to get a market rate out there? This saves about 7.5% to 10%, and we think that's a moderate change that would simply bring us a little more in line with the actual market. Also, the 8-hour rule, overtime after 8 hours, we know that we have members that have union contracts that allow people to work for weekends. Very, very common out there, especially on road projects, that you do 4-10s because you get rained out and you're working on the weekend because you can't afford. Right now, margins on public jobs are about 0 to 2%. The joke in contracting right now is if you won a public bid, run back to your office and make sure you didn't make a mistake because you probably made a mistake and are going to lose money on the job. Things are so very, very tight out there, you can't afford overtime on the jobs. So if you get rained out, you're either into the weekend or those workers are losing a day's worth of pay. So workers like doing this. I know personally I'm salaried and I have to work 5 days a week. If I could talk my boss into giving me 4 days a week, I'd be very happy with that idea. I'd be very happy to do 4-10, save me a day of daycare every week, give me a 3-day weekend. And it's very popular with our members, and I really encourage you to support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Raines. We do have one more person who has asked to testify. Okay, I guess she's not in the room.
Oh, here she is.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cecilia Rattel with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. As Senator Peterson presented to you, these are two changes that, you know, will help to ensure that all the reported wages that are given in through the survey are calculated and used when determining what the prevailing wage is. I think it's very important that you remember that this bill does not eliminate prevailing wage, and that is something that a lot of the opponents will talk about, and they'll use numbers talking about states that have prevailing wage versus non. So just remember, there's only two things that this bill does: changing the calculation from mode to mean, which, like I said, makes sure that all of the reported wages are included, and secondly, the overtime trigger at 40 hours a week. So I urge you to support this bill, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you. I think we'll move. Is there anyone else? We didn't quite use up all of our time, so if there's anyone else who wants to testify for the bill, this would be your opportunity. Mr. Hickey.
Madam Chair, members, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. I guess I'm risking testimony fatigue, but well, what the heck, one more time for this session. But I want to thank Senator Peterson for bringing this important bill forward. This change is so long overdue, as been mentioned by the other witnesses. We're simply changing from mode to numerical mean or average. It's very close to what the federal government does, and it should have been done a long time ago. We don't get a good result out of these surveys. We tend to get the union wage, and it sounds like a lot of small contractors are dissuaded by the whole thing, as we just heard from the other witness, not sending their surveys in. But, you know, if you're going to just pick the mode, guess what? That's going to come up very frequently, and many times it could be way less and save taxpayers a lot of money and stretch a job growth and projects further, and the overtime provision makes a lot of sense too, especially for workers that want to work hard for 4 days and get home quicker and have more time at home, have 3-day weekends. And so we strongly urge you to advance this bill. It's way overdue.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. And now we'll bring up people who have signed up to testify for or against the proposal. Harry Melander. And also Bill Heaney, if he would like to come up.
Senator, Madam Chair, just thank you for the opportunity. My name is Harry Melander. I'm with the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council. Our organization represents workers that work within the industry and also have thousands of contractors that work throughout the state of Minnesota. Madam Chair, I just have a very a question and just somewhat of a respectful one because of my somewhat inexperience testifying in front of finance. It was my understanding today that we're going to talk about the fiscal impact. So if someone could, maybe Senator Pedersen could talk about or explain to me in regards to the fiscal impact on the survey, or are we talking about the fiscal impact that the bill itself or the things that are happening or being proposed? I'm just a bit confused, Madam Chair. That's a respectful comment.
Certainly, Mr. Melander. I think that because Senator Pedersen is indicating that this will have a much larger fiscal impact on state contracts, that we decided to have that discussion.
Okay.
And so I guess we also are focusing on the fiscal note because the only thing that came up was what was happening in labor and industry as far as reprogramming their computers and developing rules for the new proposal. But he has brought up the issue that it has a much larger fiscal impact, and certainly if you want to contest that or question that, that.
I understand, Madam Chair. Okay. So we're talking about the broad impact that that people believe it would have on the construction industry within the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, Pearson. Members, or Mr. Melander, I to clarify my comments, in preparing for this hearing, I was told that the Finance Committee focuses on the fiscal note, and so that's what I evaluated, and I asked our nonpartisan fiscal staff. I gave them specific projects that I had known had gone on in just in the past few years, and they were unable to pull that together, and they did their due diligence, I thought, because they actually went to, I think, five or six different state agencies. And unfortunately, none of them were able to come back with a definitive answer. And so that's why I decided I had to do it on myself and find a project that was going right now. And that's the example that I brought for you here. Because the Department of Labor, and I agree with them, they are not able to book savings from outside their department. And that's understandable. I accepted that decision on their part and went out to find a project on my own when there was no state agency willing to come back with an evaluation.
Madam Chair. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I think, you know, part of the problem I'm having here is we're talking about apples and oranges. You know, Senator Pedersen thinks that this bill will reduce the costs of projects that the state bonds for. But the money you save in the amount you bond for doesn't translate to savings within the general fund of the state government. So you might save money in one place, I don't know for sure, but you can't use those savings to offset the general fund costs of running state government.
Well, Senator Berglund, there could be a connection, although I understand why the agencies do it the way they do. But if we are spending X amount on a bonding bill, say we decide to spend $700 million, either we could have maybe they give estimates as to how much projects cost, of course. You could either have more projects done, potentially, if the cost is less, or maybe we could reduce that amount to $650 million. So there could be savings in our bond payments.
Well, Senator Berglund. Madam Chair, you know, usually what happens is there's amounts set for a bonding bill, how much you're going to have in it. And you're right, if you get those projects at a lower cost, and usually that has more to do with the economy than anything else, how much they come in at, you know, then you could have more projects in there. But it doesn't change the cost of running the general fund for state government. And I think $44,000 for a rule I'm making is very reasonable. In fact, I think I'd like Labor and Industry to do the rulemaking for Health and Human Services from now on, because they always come in about twice that much to do rulemaking. So I'm just saying that we are talking apples and oranges here, because the amount it costs a state agency to run the agency to do the prevailing wage law is a different issue than how much it costs to bond for projects.
I understand that there are divisions in where the money goes, but if you think of it, it's all public dollars potentially, and it all comes from the taxpayers. So I guess I don't mind having some of this information brought forward and discussed, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, every year we have a debt payment. I think Senator Langseth can tell you that. He's been part of the bonding for years, and that's been growing and growing. Of course, some of it drops off every year. But nevertheless, those are general fund dollars that are going out every year, are they not?
Yes, Senator Ingebrigtsen. In fact, this year, I believe our debt increased $300 million, our debt payment.
So, Madam Chair, this is huge. I mean, this is, when you're talking potentially, and I think he was thinking on the lower end of, I've heard stories of even 30%, but Senator Peterson's saying even if it was 20 or 10% savings of the taxpayers that we're supposed to be the stewards of, and you're getting the same work done, I mean, this is huge, and I'm a little troubled by the departments not being able to give you the numbers, Senator. And maybe there's a good reason why they're not giving you the numbers, and that would be something that I would certainly strongly suggest that maybe the chair of this committee or somebody else, by way of letter, demand some of those projects. I just can't understand when a senator would come and ask for a project like that, why they would get, the way it sounds to me, stonewalled and not get those projects, those numbers. So I think this is something much bigger than what's being perceived here. We could really be looking at saving some huge dollars by dealing with this.
Madam Chair, to that point, and Senators, to that point, when a building is built, it's my understanding that that department needs to operate, maintain, take care of that building out of their general fund dollars. So it would clearly have an impact on general fund dollars in that manner as well. So
Madam Chair, sorry to not create some confusion, but so it's my understanding that we're going to talk about the fiscal impact in regards to what a survey might do biannually, or did you withdraw that, Senator? I'm just not real clear.
Mr. Melander, the amendment hasn't been offered, and I don't know. I think Senator Peterson may offer that yet.
Okay.
Yep.
So if you want to wait to testify and take that issue.
Oh, no. I'd like to comment, Madam Chair, okay, if I could. So
certainly, Mr. Melander.
It's my understanding that we're here today to talk about the fiscal impact about what a proposed bill is going to have on the construction industry. We weren't really prepared to talk about that, but from our past experience in other committees, I'd like to just share this with the chair of the committee members. We're looking at the impact that overtime over 40 will have on Minnesota workers, and also the method or methodology that a new type of survey will much more accurately reflect what's happening in industry. I'd just like to point out to the chairperson and also the committee members that prevailing wages in the state of Minnesota, I truly believe, accurately reflect it. There's been conversations, not so much in this committee, maybe once or twice today, about wage rates that are set by collective bargaining agreements. Those accurately, I believe, that 50% of the wage rates are set by those organizations, and the others are set by other people within the state of Minnesota. So half and half, to me, I believe, kind of accurately reflects what happens within the state. The idea of changing the model in the workplace, as a earlier testifier talked about, the impact that it'll have on individuals, the fiscal impact that it's going to have on Minnesotans is it's going to reduce workers' wages. For individuals to say that We're going to have heavy equipment standing outside the road on Thursday or Friday because we've worked 12 or 13 hours a day. I think the citizens of the state would be outraged. They're happy to see the improvements that folks like you will make, hopefully, this coming year and into the future. But to see equipment running idle where contractors aren't making money, and that's what they make money on, I think I'm not sure it accurately reflects what happens in the industry. We're very confident that people say that the law has been tightened up over the years. I mean, the method that wage determinations have been made in the state of Minnesota have existed for over 30 years. We think they, somewhat repetitively in my comment, that they accurately reflect what happens, and we would encourage the committee to take a real strong look at that. The other issue that one of the senators raised about the ability to save money, I think, really is subjective at this time. Although the senator provided data, and I'm not going to challenge that because I'm sure that it's accurate, we believe that we can also provide accurate data that will show not only here within the state of Minnesota on projects, but also projects nationally where huge modifications within prevailing wage rates have not only caused challenges within the industry in regards to safety, but also actually have increased the cost of projects. We have data that we provided in the Senate prior that wage projects or prevailing wage projects that happened in 2010 actually had a significant savings from what our state engineers had proposed. So we think that the fiscal impact here, at least within the parameters that I believe that we're talking about, are really subjective. And because it is such a big deal, we really think that there should be a significant amount of study in ample time that we can provide data that's not only happening here within the state of Minnesota, but in other places where prevailing wage modifications have actually increased the cost of construction projects that are publicly funded. But to get back to the fiscal impact, and I think that that's really important, the fiscal impact that it's going to have on your constituents is this. It's going to lower their wages. We haven't heard one time for any of our testifiers here that our employers, and our employers are our partners, but the individuals that have testified here in other hearings, they've never talked about the impact that it's going to have on their company. It's always the hands, the men and women that are out in the industry, and the fiscal impact that it's going to have on them, it'll be a savings. It'll be a cut in their paycheck. So we really hope that you give some more time to this. We've always said that we're willing to talk to participants within the industry, but we do not believe that this is a good bill for Minnesota, and we really appreciate that you would follow suit with us. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Melander. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize. I was a few minutes late, and I hope maybe you already covered this, but maybe Senator Peterson or the witnesses that are there. How many states have a prevailing wage law currently, and how many states have the method of determining what that prevailing wage is?
Senator Peterson, do you have that information?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Hand. I have a sheet from the legislative auditor's report, and I don't recall the exact date. But there would be the number of states using the mode, some type of mode. There's various types of modes. Some use a majority average. The simple mode. Mr. Melander, is that what Minnesota is a simple mode?
That's right down here, sir.
Yep. Yes. So, yeah, Minnesota is a simple mode. Right now there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's 5 states using the same method that Minnesota uses right now. But as far as the number of states that have some type of prevailing wage, I don't recall off the top of my head there.
And
Senator Hand?
Madam Chair, no, sir. I just was trying to establish whether or not what we do is it represent the majority or the sort of more dominant methodology, or are we kind of an outlier?
Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair and Senator Hand, the little angel over my shoulder said that there's 34 states that currently use some type of prevailing wage law.
And Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, I guess the concern I have, and I support your proposal, we've been trying to wrestle with various things this session, one of which is how to make Minnesota more competitive. And it seems to me that this doesn't help when we have a structure that tends to perhaps raise costs or maybe not permit some of the businesses to be able to put people to work and to compete for the jobs that are available. So to the point I think the witness had made that we've been doing this for whatever it was, 30 years or something, I guess I'm not sure that that speaks to the effectiveness of it, simply that because we've been doing it, and I don't know what the trends are across the country. If everybody started out the way that we did 30 years ago, and now you've got 40 states that have prevailing wage, and now five of them have what we have or something similar to that, maybe we're behind the times and need to adjust and become more competitive.
Mr. Melander, did you want to
Madam Chair,
that?
Senator, just in response is that, as we've said in this committee today and others, is that we really believe that this accurately reflects what's happening within Minnesota's construction industry. As the example I talked about earlier is that half of those wage rates are set by collective bargaining agreements, or at least ones that have those, and half aren't. Half and half to me really kind of says that half of Minnesota works this way, half of them works that way. We also believe that what we're doing in Minnesota works, that it's worked from 30-some-plus years, and it's good for Minnesota, and it's good for Minnesota workers. And the modification that's being proposed will do nothing but reduce the wages of the majority of workers within this industry.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mean, medium, mode. We all had to study that, but mode, simple mode versus a regular mode, what could you explain what that means? Now, you described that 50% of the workers are in each. A mode usually is finding kind of the high point in a given. But what do you mean by simple mode?
Madam Chair, if we would permit, we have a resident expert. Actually, he's a Minnesota-grown folk, though, not someone from outside the state that would probably be able to answer that much more accurately than I could.
Thank you.
Myself and Senator Pedersen decided that we are neither of us are economists, so thanks for the help.
Neither is Kyle.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I'm certainly not an economist. My name is Kyle Macarios. I work for the Carpenters Union, but I do happen to have a copy on me of the legislative audit report done in February 2007, released by a legislative auditor, which, amongst other things, summarizes, I think, what Senator Hahn is asking and what you, Senator Olson, are asking, how do other states do it, and what's the difference. So if I may, according to the February 2007 legislative audit, six of the states simply adopt collective bargaining rates. They take the union rates and they adopt them as the prevailing wage. Five use a simple mode, which means that they take the survey data, Senator Olson, Madam Chair, and they adopt that wage rate which most private sector employers are paying to most private sector employees. That wage rate, which most frequently occurs, is adopted, period. And that's simple mode. And then 14 states use what the legislative auditor refers to as the minimum percentage average or the majority average, or a modified mode, which means that they adopt the mode so long as that mode represents a certain percentage of the overall sample. So it could be 30, 40, 50%. It's different in different states. But 14 states use the mode sometimes, or, depending on the criteria, or we'll average it. One state uses the median, and two states use what Senator Peterson's bill would do, which is the mean.
So, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, is there an example that could be shown to people to see what these different things do? In other words, What is the mode? What is the mean? What is the median? How is it different if you applied it to the same group of numbers or wages? Has that ever been done? Because I think when we're grappling with that mathematical concept, we aren't necessarily all mathematical wizards sitting around just because we're on the Finance Committee. But I think that, you say this one works. I'm not sure what you mean that. Yes, it does. Anything that we do that whether it's for bonding or other projects, does put people to work. At issue is, could we put more people to work? Or is it high enough that we're getting more taxes because they're in a higher tax category because they're having higher wages? I mean, what makes this work is another. I'm leading away from it, but I still would like to see, and I think it would be helpful to people to know what the difference that is when you see an example or illustration of mean, median, mode, and simple mode versus whatever other mode. What do you mean by it works?
Was McCarius?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I don't have math sheets, and I suppose we could make up some random numbers and choose the mode and choose some averages, but I don't have that. I do believe there are some examples in this report, which I'm glad to share with you if you'd like it. But I think from our perspective, and we're opposed to this bill, one of the reasons it works is because it measures the private sector, and it asks what are the most private sector employers paying the most private sector employees in the private sector, and then certifies as prevalent or prevailing that wage rate which is most commonly paid. And so I think our perspective is that the current prevailing wage accurately sets that wage rate, which is most prevalent in the private sector.
To that.
Senator Goodwin.
Point. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say when you add all this together, because I understand that you're dividing out the modes, but when we add this together, then 19 states actually have some form of mode to calculate their prevailing wage. 6 have collective bargaining agreement. So that's 25 altogether. And only one state uses the median, which this bill is being.
Mean.
The median.
Well, aren't you proposing mean, not median? Mean.
Oh, you're proposing mean. So no state has mean then.
Two.
Oh, two do. And which two are those? Not that it matters,
Senator
but.
Kerry?
Madam
just
Chair,
curious.
Senator Goodwin, the states that you currently use the mean, according to this legislative auditor's study, are Tennessee and Vermont.
Mr. McCarius, I just wanted to understand because I when you have a project where it's the prevailing wage, and you have a company that doesn't normally pay their employees that wage, if they get the bid for that project, or do they, then they have to pay their employees that wage for that project? Is that how it works?
Madam Chair, what the prevailing wage says, I believe basically you're right, that whoever bids on our state taxpayer-funded construction projects must pay the rate that prevails in that county. And if you're going to bid on a construction project in Ramsey County, you must pay the prevailing wage for Ramsey County. That is that wage rate which most Ramsey County construction workers, according to the different classes, are paid in the private sector. And frankly, the benefit of that is it means that out-of-state contractors, in reality what it means is out-of-state contractors don't very often come do the work here in our hometowns because they can't compete with our local workforce unless they undercut our wages. And if they have to pay the wage rates that are prevailing here in our local towns, in our local areas, those out-of-state contractors don't very often do that. Because we have such highly productive workforce here that it effectively deters out-of-state contractors from importing out-of-state workers to perform our taxpayer-funded projects.
But, Mr. McCarius, if you had a company that normally had paid lower wages, the employees, though, would all love to work in the area where the higher wages were paid. Wouldn't that be true? Because they would get the higher wage. But maybe the company wouldn't like to pay it. But they're going to, they would be compensated and bidding against only those who would be paying that wage.
Madam Chair, I believe from our perspective, what the prevailing wage does is it's in the bid specs, right? I mean, the state puts a lot of things in their bid specs, and by including prevailing wage in the bid specs, it ensures that those companies that are going to bid on the project are going to bid based on who can perform the work most productively, most efficiently, rather than who can pay the workers the least in order to get the work done. And so it is certainly possible, and it certainly happens, that construction companies pay more than they might otherwise, or would bid a higher number than they might otherwise on other projects. The question is, who's going to win that bid in a competitive head-to-head bidding process? And the answer is, and it ought to be, that company which has the most highly productive, efficient workforce.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I also think that since this witness has brought up that legislative auditor study from 2007, you know, the question was asked in that study whether our existing prevailing wage law increases the costs to our projects. And they are nonpartisan. They are research-oriented, outcome-based people. And they said that the most comprehensive studies they could find generally failed to find an impact that is statistically significant. So, you know, we are going to change a law because we think we're going to get lower costs on projects, but it isn't necessarily borne out by studies that have been done. And in terms of the way they collect the wage information, they said in that report that there is no better alternative to the department's existing survey, and that the department should work on improving the number of people who respond to the survey, not change the way they conduct the survey.
Thank you. We have someone else, Mr. Heaney.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Heaney. I'm legislative director for the IBEW and Minnesota State Council. The IBEW State Council is opposed to Senate File 1199 in an absolute disagreement with all that has been said in support of it today and in all previous hearings. Now, around 60% or 9,000 of our 15,000 members potentially work on prevailing wage projects. Right now, there are over 3,000 of those people unemployed, many without health care, no job, no work, no paycheck. And that's a fiscal impact. Credible studies clearly show this bill does not help Minnesota at all. The bill brings in more non-Minnesota contractors. The bill severely cuts the paychecks of workers, and that's what this is all about. Many of those workers whom have been unemployed for a year, and many of them for 2 years. That's a fiscal impact. So, will passing this bill help out those struggling Minnesotans? Help because it will take longer for them to catch up on their mortgage, that is, if they haven't lost their home, or time help them catch up on their credit cards or utilities and medical bills, that is, if they haven't declared bankruptcy already. That's a fiscal impact, and that's what has been happening around Minnesota. Also, the ruse that this bill will create more jobs by having more money available is not supported by fact. Neither does telling a worker that they are lucky to have a job at all, so suck it up and work harder for less. And yes, that's a fiscal impact. I suppose that this bill's fiscal impact on some employers works for some. Not for me, not for my brothers and sisters who are really tired of the whole more for less thing, tired of the fiscal impact on their family of working harder and earning less. It may be easy for some people to vote for this bill, especially if they're pretty well off. Well, working people in Minnesota are not very well off at this point, and they're not stupid either. And holding out a job for less just doesn't cut it. And on your example, Senator, of the $150,000 savings, I don't think that you can sustain that example and say that that would be a booked savings to the state, because you don't know how much that contractor is dumbing down the wages of those workers in the non-prevailing wage job. And you don't know how close that is to the mode or the median or the median or anything else. So the $150,000 isn't there. And looking at projects that exist and just doing a simple calculation like that isn't sustainable either, because there's quality differences with workers and with contractors, Minnesota contractors. Thanks, versus Mark. Contractors from other states. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go into the weeds a little bit here with prevailing wage, and maybe I'm talking about Davis-Bacon, which doesn't matter here in Minnesota, or excuse me, to the state. But can you tell me those that represent unions, union workers, if there is a public-funded job and a contractor comes in and subcontracts that job, do they have to then pay prevailing wage?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, they do. Workers, if in fact it's within the bid specs, that indicates those wage rates and those occupations, all those individuals that would be on that project would be a benefactor of the state prevailing wage rate.
So, Madam Chair, if a person comes in with a, I'm a small business, and I can come in and do X amount of units for you, or whatever it is, I would still have to receive prevailing wage from that company. Otherwise, that company would be in violation.
Just a reminder.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes. If, in fact, it's spelled out within the bid specs that the minimum wage rates that are determined by county are not paid, they would be in violation of the state prevailing wage law.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Could they pay more?
Madam Chair, Senator, you betcha.
They could. Okay.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And some of the comments, I think it's Mr. Haney, made with regards to the carpenters or the members that are losing their houses. I'm here to tell you that there's a lot of private sector folks that are doing the same, and they're hurting just as much. As a matter of fact, they would work for a lot less right now, and there's a lot of people that would, and I don't care whether anybody wants to hear that or not. That's kind of the mode that we're in here right now in this state. But for us to sit here and know that we are being, again, stewards of the taxpayers' dollars, and we are going to have to pay by law, by this law that's been on the books now for 30-some years, more money for a state project just because it's a state project. The folks that I work for, when I go home and tell them that a private contractor that wants to do and can do the same work wants to bid a project lower, but he can't because of a state law, and they're going to do the same work, and somebody who's going to get actually paid more because it's on the taxpayer's roll, they're going to say, what are you doing? Why are you spending our money that way? Isn't it as basic as that?
Madam Chair, Senator, you raise a good point. There are a lot of people out there that are really hurting and are very desperate. And I don't think they'll be very happy being told that, the work you've been doing in the past, well, we're going to shove down your throat a lower wage rate because we just want to do that, or because of some idea that it's going to save taxpayer money. I don't think they're going to be happy with that. Okay, when people are desperate, they accept lots of different things. When they're hungry and they're losing their house or they're facing bankruptcy, they do lots of different things that they may not be happy about. Okay, but we're also talking about what's a fair wage for people. What can people sustain their family on? What can people go downtown in the towns in your district, Senator, and buy groceries and gasoline and go to the drugstore and buy their prescriptions and maybe a pizza once a month? It's a difference. In the other body, they talked about this bill cutting worker wages by $1.60 an hour. $1.60 an hour may not sound like a lot to you, but when you haven't worked in a year or two, it's a heck of a lot of money. And workers that work construction in good times and regularly face seasonal layoffs, they bank on that extra money they pick up in the summer and the fall, working overtime so that they can sustain themselves over the winter months when they're not working. And you want to cut $1.60 an hour out of their wages, they're not going to make it. They just aren't going to make it.
Just one more, if I could.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you for that. And so it's your opinion, if this law were to go away, to be thrown totally off the books, not just altered, be thrown away, that the state of Minnesota, through the competitive bid process of the private sector, our state would change a lot. The outlook of the whole state would change a lot.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Miller,
Senator, what as I mentioned in my comments and respectfully is that this is a real significant issue within our industry, in the tens of thousands of people, but there are many studies from people that are a lot brighter than I am, and that's not saying much, but I'm saying that actually will provide that when prevailing wages were abolished, whether it be Kansas, the state of Utah, construction prices actually went up. Yes. And we'd be more than happy to provide those to you today. We didn't know that we were going to talk about the fiscal impact of what this bill, people thought that it might have, but we can provide plenty of data to the chair and to others in the Senate that will show that time after time, and it's accurate data by academics, economists, that when prevailing wages laws have been eliminated, initially they look like they're a savings, but long-term they're a greater cost to the state.
Real quickly, so the free market in your idea, then the free market, which I think the country's been founded on, would absolutely fail. Then is that what you're telling me,
Madam Chair, Senator? Absolutely not.
Madam Chair, you know, if what we got going here is creating some kind of unreasonable cost, okay, that's something we should talk about. But this situation with out-of-state contractors versus in-state contractors, I had a relative one time that was working on construction, and he mentioned that in a neighboring state, the workers were making several dollars an hour less than they were in Minnesota. Well, now, if we have a situation, a free-willing situation there, obviously that contractor with workers in that neighboring state could underbid by quite a bit. Doesn't mean they're better. It means they pay the workers a lot less. And I also saw some figures one time where, considering that state and another neighboring states of ours, after the people paid their taxes, the average person in Minnesota, after they paid their taxes, had more money left than the workers in the other state, or the average person in the other state before they paid their taxes. So we always hear this thing about somehow Minnesota is uncompetitive. Why is it that Minnesota per capita income is so much higher than other states? It isn't because we're racing to the bottom and trying to get contractors who can pay the very least to get the job. Now, I'm always willing to look at these sort of things because maybe something's got out of line or maybe something isn't working quite right, and I'm certainly willing to do that. But I hear nowadays is if we freeze wages, we'll save the taxpayers money. If we cut workers from the payroll, we'll save the taxpayers money. There's just this whole idea that somehow if the middle class is clamped down, taxpayers are going to save a lot of money. Well, the middle class are taxpayers. And a country with a strong middle class is a prosperous country. And the rich will do fine when the middle class is out there buying. So I don't know quite how to feel about this right now because I don't know enough about some of the specifics, but just this general idea somehow that it's a good thing if you pay people less to do something because it costs less, I have a problem getting there. Because I look at some of these states that I think that's pretty much the deal. Some of these states, that are just low-income workers. And I don't want to trade places with them. I think Minnesota's got a much higher quality of life and so on. So I have to be convinced that somehow things are out of line here, and before I would support it, because there's this general idea that if you pay workers less, it's better. I don't buy.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Ingebrigtsen, with all due respect, you were talking about how the private sector is suffering. These are private sector jobs. These are not government jobs. These are private sector jobs and private sector companies that are doing business with the public and doing the public's business, roads and bridges and schools and so forth. They're working on bonding projects and so forth. So they are getting public money for doing public jobs for the public in those areas, but they are private companies. So, yeah, it does hurt the private economy when they're not getting paid appropriately. And I know even when we don't have projects for them and they don't have jobs, that hurts all of our local economies. And I have a contract firm in my district on that have been in business for 30 years, and they do oversight of construction projects for jails and schools. There's been no jails and schools being built, so they're out of business after 30 years. I'm doing an excellent job, but just no projects out there. So it's the same is true for the people that work for them. They're all out of jobs. And if we're going to reduce wages, that's going to affect our local economies, because these are based on private sector wage rates. They're not based on government jobs. The prevailing wage is based on private sector wage rates. And so you're right. It's public in that there are public dollars going into it, but they're private firms. And we're not considering in the profit factor here either, because they can write their contracts and they do to make the profit that the owners of the company want to make off of it, and still be able to pay a decent wage. That helps the local economy if a lot of those workers come from the local economy, and generally they do. That's just
Senator Magnus.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm getting confused about here what the Finance Committee is doing here. I think we're supposed to be trying to figure out if the fiscal note's right and what's going on or not. And I'm not in the Labor Committee. I don't want to get in a fight over prevailing wage. I'm trying to work with the labor guys, Harry, and you know it. You and I were on the stage today, weren't we?
You betcha, sir.
I'm trying to work with you guys, and I heard your statement about 3,000 people out of work. I'm trying to get them to work. So I got things to do besides fight about the prevailing wage right now. I just want to know if we're going to vote on the fiscal notes here, the fiscal part of the bill, or what? Because I'm not on the Labor Committee, on the Jobs Committee. If I was, we'd be putting you guys to work, because that's what I'm trying to do. But I'm sitting here. This debate's been going on for years. Everyone agrees we've got problems. Everyone agrees we've got problems with it. I'd like us to concentrate on the fiscal part of it and move on. We've got other bills here on the agenda, and I'm just not in the mood to be fighting over prevailing wage today. And this is the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Senator Magnus. Although it potentially could have some pretty big fiscal implications. Well, as they say, for the workers, for some say, for the taxpayers. And so it is an interesting issue, and I think a lot of our members haven't had this debate before and just want to get an understanding of it. But you're right. We'll move on.
I understand, Madam Chair, but again, this is a long-time debate. There's a lot of issues on it, on both sides. This is a long, this is more than just a short hearing in the Finance Committee to determine if prevailing wage is correct or not, is all I'm saying, because, there's a lot of information that we should have at our fingertips if we're going to determine if prevailing wage is the current way to go or not, or just what's going on. That's all I'm saying, Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I would request a roll call vote on this bill, and I would request that the roll call be printed in the journal.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, and I know I stepped out of the room for a minute, and maybe this has been covered. What conference committee or who's paying for this? I see that there is a general fund cost to this bill.
On the fiscal note, we're talking about the 88.
Who's carrying it? Because if nobody's carrying it, Madam Chair, it shouldn't leave this committee.
Well, Senator Higgins, it would probably go to the labor and industry, which is meeting. The conference committee is meeting now, and we were trying to figure out if we needed to put an appropriation in there for that, or how we would address the funding. I know sometimes in the past they've had the agencies absorb the costs. I don't know if we can. I think we would like to talk to John from Labor and Industry just to talk a little more about the fiscal note, if he's still here, and find out. I know there's some senators questioning how it was arrived at, and perhaps we could get a little further explanation. Welcome. I don't think we have John.
No John's here. Madam Chairman, members, my name is Ken Peterson, the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. And with me is Rosalyn Wade, who's the head of the Labor Standards Division, who does the calculations for the prevailing wage issues. And I understand that we did submit a fiscal note on this bill, and the total cost, to the best of our estimation, is $88,000. On these fiscal notes, there were some issues early on. Fiscal notes are difficult when you're the commissioner. You want to make them. I'm a cheap person. I wear old suits. I wear old clothes. I get cheap haircuts, as you can well see. So I demand that our stuff, we try to do things as leanly as possible. So I look at these fiscal notes, I always say, it's got to be less than that. And I did in this one. But the way it came, but ultimately I think this is the best we can do, the most honest, as close as we can get to the fiscal cost. Hopefully, with a lot of these, we can maybe absorb it, I don't know. But there is a cost. The chief cost is the administrative rulemaking, and as Senator Berglund mentioned, that this was a low one. What you do, the Department of Administration gives examples, or gives you sort of, they have a chart of different rulemaking examples. 44,000 is the lowest one. We picked that. So we put in 44,000. The next highest number is potential of $28,000 in challenges to the rules, or to the, not to the rules, but to the wage findings. The problem with this thing is you have 208 job classifications, and you get to like 21,000 possible prevailing wages. You see, you do it by an account by, for the highways, you put on the 10 regions for the MnDOT regions, and then you also do it on a county-by-county basis. So you take that 208, multiply that times 87 counties, or the MnDOT regions. You can see why you get a lot of numbers. So that's why when you have an average with a mode, you just pick the most popular numbers, not popular, the most common number. And so you'll get if you have 100 submissions, 50 are one wage, you can just pick that one. But with a mean, as is proposed in this bill, you have to pick the average, and if one number's off, the average is off. So that's why we're concerned about having somebody will come in and say you did the wrong average, you used the wrong numbers, and so they'll challenge it. So the mode is more immune to challenges. I was telling Senator Peterson today, we may not have any challenges. Hopefully we don't. We don't like doing that stuff. But I think there is a possibility we will. So we put in 4. It could be 3, could be 10. I don't know. But this is the best estimation we could come up with from what we know of the area we're moving into. But we really don't know. And in terms of the computer time, I think we're pretty accurate there. The 14,000 and the other ones. I think our findings are reasonably accurate, as close as we can be. So, but if you have specific questions, Ms. Wade can certainly answer those. We try to keep this as low as possible. I hope we're right. We're doing the best we can.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Peterson, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Did members have any specific questions for Ms. Wade about arriving at the fiscal note? Senator Perry, you wanted to ask about the computer costs, perhaps?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess earlier I'd made some comments about you know, require modifications to a computer program to the tune of $14,000 at an hourly rate, which appears to be about $116-$117 an hour. And I'm going, what is it that would even kick in something that would take 120 hours to do?
Madam Chair, Senator.
Ms. Wayne.
I certainly understand your concern. However, when there is any need that relies on technology, we have somewhat sophisticated IT unit within the Department of Labor and Industry. It is that unit that built the current prevailing wage system. It is, we rely on the computer to actually do the analysis. Our role in the survey is to gather the information, input the data into the system, but we rely on the reliability of the technology to accurately identify the rate that is to be determined. All of the information go into it. As the commissioner indicated, the mode is fairly simple in terms of the most often occurring number. It will require significant changes because this is a significant change to the analysis. This number was provided to the unit based on the specific question, understanding what is required, understanding the existing system, moving the system from calculating and identifying the mode to taking into specific consideration every wage data element that is submitted for a classification. The contractor that has been used to do the majority of the prevailing wage work, that is the hourly fee. And $116 may sound high, but in the IT market, that's not unreasonable for an IT consultant or programmer. These numbers were provided to me based on specific and direct requests to an individual that understand the existing system and understand what changes need to be made. I can't compare it to your, you indicated earlier on, you did some significant upgrades and it only cost $1,000. I don't know what you're doing with your programs.
Thank you, Ms. Wade. Senator Nino?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I understood, correct me if I'm misinterpreting what you said, but to boil down what you said with your opening remarks is that you use human resources, people do the data entry, and the systems then do the calculations. So essentially you need a computer program to do some math. Is that for calculating this, is that correct?
Sure, that's Ms. Wade. Yes, I would agree with that.
Madam Chair, you know? Why couldn't you use an off-the-shelf database program or an Excel spreadsheet?
Ms. Wade.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe that there are many options out there, but considering the volume of information that is pulled into the system that currently is used has been reliable. As one of the earlier testifiers indicated, the legislative auditor not only looked at our program, but also looked at the prevailing wage program, but they also looked at the computer technology because there are components of the prevailing wage law that takes into consideration many different things, in particular, adjacent counties, which is noted in there. The reliability of the program has been demonstrated. It doesn't mean that there aren't other options out there or maybe even better options, but this note was prepared to take into consideration what modifications would be needed to the existing system in order to move from the mode to the mean. That's not to say that there aren't other options out there.
Are there any other questions for the testifiers? Senator Ingebrigtsen?
If not, I'm certainly willing to move the bill.
Senator Peterson?
Madam Chair, I do need to offer an A1 amendment, an author's amendment to Senate File 1199. I've only been here for a few months, so you have to forgive me. But I'm told or advised that, I need to offer this amendment to match it up with a fiscal note. My intention was, I thought, by doing the survey twice biannually, once every 2 years, rather than every year, was going to cut the cost in half, and it only reduces it by, you know, whatever, $9,000 or $13,000. And so, but staff did prepare the fiscal note based on this amendment, so I do need to offer the A1 amendment.
Okay. Is there a discussion on the A1 amendment?
There won't be until we see it.
Do we have it?
I'm sorry.
Madam Chair and members, I can explain it. Yeah, what this amendment does relating to this bill specifically, you're probably aware by this time that the survey is done on an annual basis through the Department of Labor and Industry, where employers will send in their wage rates. And originally I was working off information that there was two full-time people doing that at the Department of Labor, and so naturally, you know, on other fiscal notes I've seen one person with their wages and benefits cost $100,000. And so when the fiscal note came back at about $100,000, that was my thought. Well, let's do the survey biannually, and then the fiscal note goes away because we would have $100,000 savings. Well, as you can see, it doesn't work out that way. It might have worked out that way in the block business, but not in the Department of Labor and Industry business, but I'm not here to criticize the fiscal note. Like I said, I feel like I've given you ample documentation that shows that the savings would be there, and so that's what this fiscal note or the amendment does, is simply do the survey every 2 years rather than every year.
Any questions about the amendment? Senator Peterson?
In addition to that, I do need to offer an oral amendment to strike subdivision 4 so that it does match with, or to strike subdivision 4 to match up with the fiscal note as well.
Senator Perry?
Madam Chair, I would agree with his oral amendment to get rid of subdivision 4. If we leave that in, it'll certainly get shot back to my committee, and I don't believe there's any need for that. As I take a look at that already, Mr. Bonner, and you might help me with this, but I believe already they have the rulemaking authority, and this would fall under the current rulemaking authority. Is that correct?
Mr. Bonner?
Madam Chair and Senator Perry, there's an existing section of the Administrative Procedure Act that gives agencies the authority to amend rules to conform with statutes. Agencies like to have language like this put into bills because it confirms they can use this section, but they are certainly free to make that case themselves if they need to amend the rules. They have that authority.
Madam Chair?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Peterson, would the effect of this amendment be that the wages would kind of lag? I mean, you know, when we go through, you know, economic hard times like we've been going through, bids come in lower for private jobs. So then the prevailing wage would be lower. And if you aren't doing another survey for 2 years and the economy is recovering, then you wouldn't be showing that in the prevailing wage. And the converse is true also when, you know, if you're only doing it every 2 years and the economy has been going down, you would have higher prevailing wages in your data than actually would be going on out in the economy.
It's Commissioner Peterson.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, there would be a lag that you'd be getting the facts from year one would be applying to both year one and year two. It would be year one and year two. So sometimes it would be a little lower, other times it would be higher. It would vary. You would not have as close of an approximation. At the same time, I'm not sure it would be that great in most cases. I don't think it would be that great of differences. But I'm not really sure. We originally thought, Madam Chairman, that I remember telling Senator Peterson we could save $100,000 a year if we only had to do a survey every 2 years. And then we looked at it, and it's not the case. We'd hoped we could, but we thought about it, and it made sense on the top of your head, but too often we shouldn't talk off the top of our head, I guess. I certainly would. But anyway, so that was our feeling. But we do believe there would be a lag here. And so sometimes I could be higher, sometimes be lower. I'm not sure it would be that great of a difference, though, Senator. You know, what I'm talking, Madam Chair, I just want to bring one thing up, is that this is nothing that, in reference to what Mr. Melander said, that as we all know, this is a very contentious issue, and the governor knows that, as the time we spent here. He is saying that he would like to, before he condition his support on some sort of agreement between management and labor. I wanted to bring that out just to make sure that people can, so to encourage both sides to continue to negotiate. It's not to say you should or should not pass this bill, but that he would certainly want to encourage both labor and management sides to work on this, and hopefully that I've said that to Senator Peterson already, so we just want to encourage that to happen.
Madam
I want
Chair.
To bring that out.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Peterson? Two Petersons we've got to cope with here today.
He's the good-looking
one. I wish I was the commissioner.
Thank you. Commissioner, when the surveys are conducted, do the employers file that data electronically and in a form that you can process it electronically too, or is it they come a, you know, on backs of napkins and other sorts of things that you have to translate and input and all that kind of stuff.
Madam Chair, as I understand, it comes in both ways.
It's not coming in a uniform form.
But it can come in electronically, but not everybody's able to submit it. We'd prefer it to be electronically, but not everybody can do it.
That would affect cost.
Could I ask, usually with union contracts, they're done in like 2 years, so I don't know, would they change very much in a two-year period? I think they can do incremental wage increases, I suppose, within the contract period. But are they usually not done in 2 years? And you could just nod your head, Mr. Melander.
Two or three.
2 or 3 year contracts. Okay, I was wondering about that, Senator Magnuson. I know we'll get to it.
Thank you. Well. I've gone past that time now, so I'm ready to ask some more questions, Mr. Peterson, because Senator Peterson's piqued my interest here a little bit with this amendment, but I've got a question for the commissioner and others. Do city and county, are city and county governments subject to the prevailing wage laws in the state?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, if there's state money involved. If there's state money involved with it.
Okay. So, Madam
Senator
Chair, because I didn't want to get into this. I didn't want to get into this, Commissioner. But let's just say, for example, I have six counties that I represent. And they do road construction. In fact, they're doing more road construction every year. Because I don't believe that when they do their work there, that, for example, they have a motor grader operator out there that's making, in my counties of southwest Minnesota, $17, $18, $19 an hour, something like that. I happen to have talked to a friend of mine here recently that does road construction work, and I think the road motor grader operator into the prevailing wage laws we have now is something like $36 or $7 an hour. So, you know, not only does the poor guy running the motor grader operator for the county kind of want to do some of the high-paid jobs, that's what they call them, high-paid jobs, prevailing wage jobs, he's not too happy about working for the county. when he could get a job doing this. The trouble is we don't have any jobs out there to do that. That's all dried up. That's all dried up. Folks, we got to get folk people to work. So on the other hand is, now we got that situation. Can't get anybody to run the motor grader operator for the county if, in fact, we do have construction jobs down there, because he's going to take this job and go. And when we get into the situation under Senator Peterson's bill here, where you're locked into the 8-hour maximum, and then you've got a company out there trying to do road construction work, and you got weather like this, and it's not working. It's about as frustrating as I am trying to get the crops planted. And you can't get it done, and then lo and behold, you've got a time limit in your contract, and you can't get that done. So here you're stuck. You're paying pretty good wages in our six counties down there, and then looking at overtime, and then looking at a penalty you got to pay if you're not getting it done on time. So this is a compounding problem. That's why I said it's very disturbing, and I'm glad to hear the governor's concerned about. I certainly am. I would like to see some resolution to it. But it gets more down to the problem going back to the poor guy in the county here. The counties are understanding this and need to get construction work done out there, so they're trying to do as much work as they can themselves. See? Because believe it or not, there's only so much money to go around. Only so much money to go around. So they're taking more jobs on every year they can, trying to squeeze more money out, trying to get more money out of the counties. They set their rates, trying to do this, whether it's crushing gravel and now the county's got, instead of the local guys having their rock crushers out there running gravel pits. The counties have taken them all over. And you got them doing all the work on the roads that are private guys. I like the private guys working. I like him working, you know. So we got to get some sense to this, Commissioner. I didn't want to get involved in this argument, but it's come to this. And I see public and private highway. Do the counties and do the others report to the surveys? Do they respond? I mean, that's an actual guy, this motor grader operator, my example, making, let's just say, $19 an hour. I can call him up. I got friends that do it. We all know this. I'm not telling you any secrets, guys. We all know it in the audience. We all know it. Are they reporting under this? And, you know, if they're not, maybe they should be reporting also. Maybe they wouldn't be feeling as quite as bad as the small local companies that don't want to tell their competition what they're paying. Or maybe they don't want to respond to this. Or maybe they've got 5 trucks instead of 200, like Ms. Donovan said. You know, and overwhelmed by the number on this. So that's some of the questions I've got in my mind. And I, you know, again, I didn't want to get into this in the Finance Committee, but these are the concerns I have in my mind. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus,
Commissioner Peterson,
one of the points of the Legislative Auditor's Report in 2007 was hopeful that we would increase the response rate to people on to the prevailing wage surveys. The gentleman you're talking about, the people you're talking about, gentlemen or gentlewomen, whoever they are, we try to reach them. We do the best we can to reach them to have the contractors respond and tell us what the rates are. We try to reach the counties, we try to reach whatever they are, to tell us what they're paying people. We want to know so we can have the best possible rate. Unfortunately, we don't have as high a response rate as we'd like. We'd like to have a much higher rate. We'd like to give 100%. Would like to have, you know, the more we get, the better we have, the more accurate the rate will be.
Well, Madam Chair and Commissioner, maybe we put some incentives in there that folks do that then. You know, I guess we write laws and statutes every day. Maybe we put some incentives in to say, you're going to respond to this. At least certainly the county and state governments step up. You know, if we're not getting... If the testimony is correct and we're not getting an adequate number of response to the surveys, then maybe we sit down and we write some laws to entice people, encourage them to do that. I'm trying to figure out what we're going to say to the governor when we're trying to figure out how we're going to increase jobs here and get people working. So,
Thank you, Senator Magnus.
Madam Chair, Senator.
Miss, I'm looking for your name again.
Wade.
I'm sorry.
Senator, I just like to share that the dominant survey that gets talked about is the contractor survey, but our current rule requires that our office survey city and county engineers. So absolutely every city in Minnesota is surveyed. Every county engineer receives a survey to identify all contractors, both public performing work, public and private construction projects, identify those contractors so that we are assured that our mailing list is updated. Within that process, even the city and county work that is performed can be submitted. We strongly encourage participation at all levels.
And Madam Chair, how's that response going? Are you getting responses back from them? I mean, are you getting, let's just say for the six counties that I represent, that's a pretty big area. And if those six counties, let's just say with the motor grader operator, are they sending in, we're paying these guys $19 an hour? Is that what you're getting back? Is that the response you're getting back? Or am I totally all wet on this thing that, we've got the county workers making $19 an hour, and we got the prevailing wage other worker here getting $36.7 an hour.
Ms. Wade, are they coming back in? Are the surveys being returned?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, we do get a significant amount of wage data. Unfortunately, I don't know your specific area, but it certainly is something that I'd be willing to look into to see how many contractors are reporting, what type of wage data we receive from your area.
Madam Chair,
Senator Magnus.
I'd be interested in information. I want to get your legislative liaison something to do, so I want to talk to him about that.
I think we should come back now to the A1 amendment on the...
We're on the oral amendment. There's an oral amendment to the A1 amendment.
Just incorporate it.
Well, we were just going to incorporate it.
It's his amendment. He can incorporate it.
Oh, we haven't. The amendment has not been offered. So would you like to offer the A1 amendment, Senator Perry?
I'll offer the A1 amendment.
Okay. As without... The subdivision four deleted.
That's what I was questioning. If I'll offer the A1 amendment with the oral amendment at the same time to delete subdivision four, which starts on line 1.16.
Okay.
Through 1.18, the period.
Okay. Is there any more discussion on that? We did have a discussion on it already, so I think it's time to vote. All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. So now back to the bill.
Senator Berglund asked not to to wait until she got back in the room to vote.
Okay, and Senator Bonoff has to leave very
Madam
shortly.
Chair, Madam Chair, we could do a roll call and hold it open for her.
She did, that's right.
I think she'll be right back. We can bring her right back in.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, if I might, I just want to tell Senator Peterson, I think the amendment is a good thing. I think listening to all that goes into taking those surveys, the idea of doing it every other year makes some good sense. So while I may not support the whole bill, I do think that's an improvement.
So, Senator...
She's right behind
back.
You.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, would you...
I would move Senate File 119 as amended. And refer to jobs and economic growth. Is that correct?
No.
Okay.
It's already been there.
Okay.
So it would be referred to general orders.
That would be my motion.
Okay, Senator Ingebrigtsen moves Senate File 1199 as amended, and we will take a roll call vote, which will be recorded in the journal.
Madam Chair, did you ever answer Senator Higgins' question about whether we're asking the department to absorb this cost, or are we appropriating this money to them?
Nobody did answer that.
Senator Brigland, we don't have the appropriation in this bill. So at this point, the department would be absorbing it, but I am going to take this issue to the committee that is meeting on this to see if we can get some money for it. I didn't realize at first that it would be this big. I know that Senator Peterson had been working to bring the fiscal note down, but we'll talk to the department and to the chairs of the committee to see if we can get some funding for this.
Well, Madam Chair, just a comment. You know, my understanding is those conference committees are cutting all the state agencies about 35%. So asking them to absorb something, I think, is really...
Madam Chair, I don't think that's the right number, at least not in my committee. So I you know, respectfully wish that we wouldn't be throwing out numbers to again try to incite. Now, if we want to get into the whole discussion here, Senator Berglund, about what our governor did, we want to bring up the veterans and how he's using them as a pawn, let's discuss it. But
Senator,
don't be throwing out those kind of numbers.
Senator Perry, please.
Madam Chair, if I could just
Senator
finish.
Berglund.
My understanding is that budgets are being cut in the first committee and then budgets are being cut again in another conference committee. And when you add it all up, to get to around that number. And I'm just saying, when we're cutting agencies that much, I think it's irresponsible to expect that they absorb new projects and new responsibilities.
I understand, Senator Berglund, and I will go and try and find some additional funding if this does pass. So,
Madam Chair.
Senator Langston.
Madam Chair, quite a long time ago, I was one of 11 Democrats that jumped ship and voted for the workers' comp reform. But I'd had time to take a good look at it, and there was things that were out of line, and we needed to make changes. That may be possible with this as well. I don't know, but I, at this point, I'm not going to support the bill, but I suppose it'll pass out of the legislature, and hopefully maybe with the administration and the author of the bill, maybe they can come out with something where there will be some things that then maybe reported better or something. Because I don't want to say that you're not on the track at all, but right now I'm just not ready to vote for the bill as it is.
Thank you. The roll will be taken.
Senator Berglund?
No.
Senator Bonhoff?
No.
Senator Goodwin?
No.
Senator Hahn? Senator Higgins?
No.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes.
Senator Langseth?
No.
Senator Magnus?
Yes.
Senator Newman?
Yes.
Senator Nienau?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Perry?
Yes.
Senator Roebling?
Yes. On a vote of 6-5, the motion does prevail, and the bill is approved and will be sent to general orders. Thank you, Senator Peterson. Thank you, everyone who testified. And thank you, Commissioner. Our next bill up is Senate File 389. It is Senator Gazelka's bill. Members, we had laid this bill on the table. Last time we had a lengthy discussion on it, and so we'll take it off the table. It's on no-fault auto insurance, the basic economic loss benefits modifications. Welcome, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this has the potential to be very quick. You know, one of the issues that we had last time was the fiscal note accurate? A brand new one came out from, well, I believe there were six agencies that took a look at it, and it frankly did not cost the state any money. But since that time, this bill stalled in the House, where in Commerce Committee they had a meeting of the minds that the chiropractor industry and the insurance industry and myself and Representative Loon and maybe some others should get together between now and next year and see if there's a solution that we can do without this legislation. I think the legislation, frankly, is still very good. As I mentioned before, no-fault insurance is primarily the $20,000 of medical benefits that are required under your auto insurance policy. 24 states used to have this coverage. We're down to 9. The rest have repealed it because it's become too expensive. It has no accountability, but if the chiropractic industry is interested in taking a look at it and bringing accountability from their perspective, I think that's a good thing in the end if we can all work together. Part of the reason I'd like to see it passed is just to make the point that we have begun to move forward on this type of legislation if there are no reforms.
So, Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Gonzalka, I don't think making a point is the reason to pass a bill. Madam Chair, do we have this on the table at this point?
I just took it off.
You just took it off, Madam Chair. I moved to put it back on the table then, as long as they're going to have discussions over the interim and it's not moving in the other house.
Senator Gazelko, was that your intention, or you wanted us to take
it? I would prefer, Madam Chair, that you take it up, that we actually have the conversation, and that it gets passed. I'm just trying to be open with how I see the bill being addressed, but I'll leave it to the discretion of the chair.
So you're moving to lay the bill on the table. So we'll take a vote on that issue. All in favor of Senator Higgins' motion to lay the bill on the table, signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, no.
No.
No. I think the motion did not prevail. So, Senator Gazelka, you did indicate we had laid it on the table because there was a question about the fiscal impact and whether or not several other agencies had been surveyed on it.
Yep.
And it did go out for that review and came back without showing a fiscal impact. We do have Mr. Goodenough is here to testify on the bill, if he would like to come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Goodenough. I'm here representing the Minnesota Chiropractors Association. And as Senator Gazelka mentioned in the House, when the bill came up in Commerce Committee, it was laid over there with the intention that the association, the interested legislative authors in both the House and the Senate, and also other groups, including the insurance industry, would work on compromise language that would deal with appropriate evidence-based treatment parameters for chiropractors in the no-fault system, and also an ability to identify and address the outliers and abusers in the system. And with that and with the understanding in the House was the bill was laid over in that committee. We do remain opposed to the bill as written, and I do want to just express some concerns about the fiscal notes you did receive and just highlight a few points that should be considered with the current bill. Let me just start from the back on page 13, the MMB. Talks about the impact to CGIP, and they specifically state, although MMB does expect to incur additional claims expense through the Advantage Health Plan as a result of this legislation, we are unable to generate an estimate of the cost with reasonable accuracy. They acknowledge in their fiscal note that there is an impact on the state costs. They're just saying that they're not able to come up with an accurate fiscal note of projected costs. I think if they spent a little bit of time getting some information from the insurance industry, considering they know how many insured lives they have, they could probably do a rough calculation of the potential cost of the state. Additionally, if you look at page 7, that's the Department of Labor and Industry fiscal note. Their fiscal note says the bill will not impact workers' compensation benefits provided injured workers or increase assessment on the insurers of the self-insured. That may be true, but if you look at the reference to the treatment parameters within the workers' comp system for these people that are injured under no-fault auto, it makes a reference to those treatment parameters, and to go beyond the 12-week limit, you need to go and you need to get the permission either from the insurance companies or from the commissioner. So there's a process in place to go beyond the treatment parameters that are included in the bill, which involves the commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. That assessment and that mechanism, the impact of that process on the system was not taken into account when the Department of Labor looked at this fiscal note. Finally, looking at the Department of Human Services, they again said that they didn't feel that it was a major impact on the state because it was a minor, the chiropractic and therapies were a minor part of the Medicaid and Minnesota care programs. However, if you look at the bill and the way it's written, it defines soft treatment injury as all treatments covered in Rule 5221, except for those that are performed by osteopaths and medical doctors. And that includes then all treatments. It goes beyond soft tissue treatments. It goes into other types of treatments as well that are performed by providers that aren't those two. And so it does have a wider impact than chiropractic and physical therapy. Also, the calculation of Minnesota care, there are, my last calculation, I'm sorry, Senator Berglund may know this better, but it's a 700,000 range of the number of people that are covered on those health care programs. It won't be that difficult to extrapolate based on the information if they were to receive it from the insurance industry, what a potential fiscal note is on the Minnesota care and Medicaid populations as well. So just briefly looking at this, and granted, I didn't see this until this afternoon, but just looking at the fiscal note that you have received from those agencies, I do think there's some flaws in it. I think there was some lack of maybe some time spent on it because I understand there's a lot of other pressures looking at some other bills that are going through that they had to rush through and get some fiscal notes done. And I think more time needs to be spent on the fiscal impact of this bill. And so I'd respectfully and ask that the bill not proceed out of committee. We do remain opposed to Section 1 of the bill. We remain supportive of Sections 2 and 3 of the bill. Again, another really easy solution is to delete Section 1 and move Sections 2 and 3 out. I don't think we're there yet, but I just wanted to throw a compromise on the table, Senator Gazelka. With that, I appreciate the committee's time.
Senator Gazelka.
Madam Chair, if I can just make one comment, I am glad that there is now an acknowledgement that there are some outliers in this issue. That's a first.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
It strikes me how much of state statute we could get rid of if we went to single-payer insurance. We could get rid of this auto insurance mess. We could get rid of workers' comp. We could get rid of all manner of things that are thorny problems to us. And the time will come when it makes sense to do that.
Senator Berglund.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that it's a good idea that the House has laid this bill over for interim study. And I feel very uncomfortable that we're not laying it over, that we're going to move ahead and ask people to vote on something when we don't have all the information we should have. We don't exactly know how broad the impact will be in terms of the care that people need. What we heard at the last hearing was that this doesn't just involve chiropractic care. It's anything that affects the tissue or bones within the body. Well, in auto accidents, that's most everything. I mean, you know, I had I tore a ligament in my knee getting into my car, and lo and behold, I discovered that my health insurance wasn't supposed to pay for that. I wasn't driving my car, but because it was happening while I was getting into my car, my auto insurance had to pay for that. And I had to have surgery to have that knee, that ligament repaired. Well, I think that would be covered under this bill, that ligament had to be repaired surgically. I don't think this is not just a small thing that's related to one type of practitioner. And so I feel very uncomfortable passing this bill out of this committee.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
And Senator Higgins, we did have 3 hours of in-depth discussion on this. I will say that, on an auto claim, the average chiropractor visits are about 32 when somebody's injured, versus on a work comp claim, it's about 10. And so it's a much smaller number when you have to have accountability and show that there's improvement. So that's why I don't think there's that many people that make it beyond the 12 weeks, but there are some, and there are, frankly, some exceptions for people to go beyond 12 weeks in those cases. And finally, Madam Chair, if I can just say, but back to the fiscal note, I mean, this was the second one we did because we wanted to verify, and again, it came back with the numbers we had.
Those fiscal notes. I know everybody on each side, you know, has had disagreements with them, that's for sure. Well, members, I can take a motion.
Madam Chair, it really isn't going anywhere. And even if it passes out of here, it still isn't going to go anywhere. So why would we expend the effort to send it anywhere?
Madam Chair, maybe
Senator Gazelka, I'm thinking perhaps it should be laid on the table again.
Madam Chair, I certainly respect that. I'm new, and maybe that's the direction I was recommended is not quite appropriate, and so I respect that.
I mean, this is a biennial session, so we can certainly pick it up again next session. And in the meantime, if there's some more work to be done, we will have some time for that.
That is absolutely fine.
So,
okay, now I'll move to lay it on the table.
Again. Senator Higgins moves again to lay it on the table. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
Thank you, Madam
Senator
Chair,
Gazelka.
Members. Have a good night.
We have one bill left, and it is Senate File 1159. Senator Lilly, thank you for being patient. I know this has taken a little longer than members expected.
I'm almost out of mint, so she's going to have
Senator Lilly, welcome.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much. I appreciate you staying to this late hour for one more bill. We are going to be talking about the Workers' Comp Advisory Council's bill. This is an agency bill or for that council today. And this bill has already been through the Jobs Committee and through the State Government Committee. And basically, just a very quick review, the Workers' Comp Advisory Council is basically a part of the Department of Labor and Industry. And I am joined by Assistant Commissioner Gary Hall, who will help explain the bill a little bit and answer any of your questions. And I understand that Tim O'Malley is in the room also, and he will join us at the table to answer a couple questions also. But a very quick background. The Workers' Comp bill jointly and unanimously was approved by business and labor through the Workers' Comp Advisory Council. It was brought to the council by the attorneys representing both the insurers, employers, and those representing injured workers. The bill addresses a number of areas that need to be corrected and updated in the workers' comp policy, including the timing of settlement conferences. And one of the issues with conferences is that it has taken as long as 212 days to schedule conferences, and this bill's goal is to reduce that time to 180 days or less. It also addresses flexibility in scheduling, the use of experienced and independent decision makers at hearings. It changes the formula in calculating medical fees for drug use to treat a workers' compensation industry. And the bill also makes some technical changes incorporating existing workers' compensation law enacted in 1998. And I believe that we have one amendment to the bill, and if I could move that oral amendment at this time, I would appreciate that. The amendment is, it's a single word change, and it's on line 10.5, section 20, 10.5, and we are seeking to change on that line, the 10.15, excuse me. Thank you, Gary. Change from the commissioner shall to the commissioner may replace the average wholesale price standard. So,
Chair, what page is that on, Senator?
On page 10, line 15.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Perry will move that the shall be changed to may. Is there further discussion about that? Welcome. Did you want to address the amendment?
Not that amendment. Gary, would you like to address that one?
The
shell to me?
Oh, sure.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Gary Hall. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Safety and Workers' Compensation at the Department of Labor and Industry. This amendment, I should explain that Section 20, the change in the formula for determining the medical fee limits for pharmaceutical drugs, we put this change in initially. We recommended it to the advisory council, and they discussed it based on the assumption that the average wholesale price standard was going to be no longer published as of September. Mm-hmm. Without that number, we can't calculate a fee limit for our fee schedule. Since then, we found out that there are some publishers who are going to continue to publish it, but there's still some legal questions about whether or not those publications are going to be challenged as the first one was. So in order to give ourselves some flexibility, we're asking to have the shall change to a may so that the commissioner can make a determination as the summer goes on whether or not the industry is going to go towards the average wholesale price as a standard or towards the warehouse or wholesale acquisition cost. And this is just a matter of which number we use to start the calculation to come up with the maximum fee. Doesn't change the actual maximum fee in our fee schedule.
Are there any questions about that? Sounds like it gives a commissioner more flexibility.
Yes.
As things are evolving.
Madam Chair.
So all in favor of Senator Perry's amendment to, it's an oral amendment on page 10, line 15, to change the shall to may, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. And then to the bill.
All right. Madam Chair, members, this bill has been a work in process. We've had a number of amendments. I am very hopeful that this is the last amendment that this bill will see as we move forward. But again, it has been a bill that has been worked jointly by myself and by Senator Kielash. He is on the Workers' Comp Commission also. And we have worked together on this bill. And at this time, I'd like to have Assistant Commissioner Gary Hall just run through the bill as quickly as possible. I know that you all want to move on to other meetings this evening.
Only the fiscal pieces.
Commissioner Hall. The fiscal
ones. Madam Chair, members, before I go through it, I'd just like to, for the record and on behalf of the agency, thank Senator Lilly and the other legislative members of the Advisory Council for all the work they put into it, and especially David Olson, the president of the chamber, and Cher Knudsen, the president of the AFL-CIO. They've all put a lot of work into coming to a consensus on this bill, and it's very much appreciated by the Department of Labor and Industry. There are a number of changes in the bill, and they're in a number of different places. So what I've done is I've put them into categories, and I'll go through seven categories. And if anyone has any questions on a specific provision, I'd be happy to answer it. The first category are provisions that require that only compensation judges be used in workers' compensation hearings. And there are a number of reasons why the council agreed on this, but primarily it has to do with the nature of the work comp law, how complicated it is, and the necessity for a contract judge or a judge who isn't familiar with workers' compensation to get up to speed. It takes more time in hearings. We're looking to try to speed up the system, and we wanted to have people that had experience in work comp due to the complexity of the subject matter.
Commissioner Hall, this won't delay hearings, will it? Do you have enough judges, compensation judges, to handle the caseload? Because I'm assuming that at times you may have been bringing in some outside judges, but now you're saying you're not going to do that?
Madam Chair, members, the Office of Administrative Hearings handles the cases. Most of these changes affect the process over in their agency. Assistant Chief Tim O'Malley is here. He could probably respond to that better than I could. Did you want?
Madam Chair, my name is Tim O'Malley. I'm an assistant chief judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings. One of my duties is to oversee the workers' comp division at the Office of Administrative Hearings. And yes, we do have enough judges. We are constantly assessing that and are implementing some other changes, including our use of attorneys and our use of some support staff, so that the judges spend their time only on judicial matters. But right now, we are fine with this. The only time that we would need to use an outside judge, and it's permitted under the changes here, would be if there's a conflict. For example, if a family member of one of the judges, one of the current judges, is an injured worker or is involved in the case somehow, and this would permit us to then go outside of the Office of Administrative Hearings. But otherwise, yes, and this would move, it would not in any way delay. In fact, it'll help move the cases along faster.
Thank you, Judge O'Malley. Please continue, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members, the second grouping of changes are housekeeping changes. There are amendments to various sections that simply codify existing law. In 1998, there were a number of changes made to the work comp process that weren't codified, that weren't given statutory numbers. And when we came to do the amendments to these particular sections, it was necessary to put those existing law changes into this actual statute. And that's what all these housekeeping changes do. They don't change existing law at all. The third category is changes that require the use of a different compensation judge for de novo hearings. The law requires that the office, at this time, it requires the office assign cases on a block system. And the Office of Administrative Hearings, with a strict interpretation of the statute, felt they needed to assign the same judge to an administrative conference where there was a decision issued, and to the basically an appeal, even though it's a de novo hearing, from that same conference. Now, it probably is apparent to a number of you that that would cause some concern among the parties to the case to have the same judge hear the thing on appeal. And so these changes just make it clear that a different judge has to hear the formal hearing than the judge that heard the informal proceeding. The fourth category I have here are changes that speed up the process and require settlement conferences. These are significant changes, and Senator Lilly referred to the time frame. The attorneys agreed to this, but even they are a little concerned that this is going to put them in a tough position because they're going to have to move fast to get these things prepared for hearing, get discovery done. They're basically cutting 30 days off of an already tight schedule. But we're looking forward to having the cases heard faster and having resolutions for injured employees quicker. Category number five is the provision I talked about initially that uses a different formula to calculate the maximum fee for prescription drugs. Category number six is a provision that it's a change to 176.137, which allows for remodeling of injured workers' residences where there's a permanent disability. Both sides, the labor and business, negotiated over this provision considerably. The end result is that the cap for remodeling was increased from $60,000 to $75,000. And that's a number that hadn't been changed since the mid-90s. In return for that, there's a change in the requirement that an architect provide oversight and approval on some projects. Now, the lack of architect approval on some of the smaller projects is going to save money for both the insurer and for the employee, depending on how close they are to that cap. If the architect costs are included in the cap. So if the cost of the project is under the cap, the employees' benefits would cover it. The insurer would cover it. If it's over the cap, the employee would have to cover it. In this case, it makes an exception for projects where the building official in the area and the contractor and the disability council all agree that an architect isn't necessary. The final provision that is in the bill is the $600,000 appropriation. It's intended to help create a case management system at the Office of Administrative Hearings. And again, this is something that Assistant Chief Judge O'Malley would know more about.
Madam Chair, Assistant Chief Judge O'Malley talk about the software that is necessary to schedule our judges.
Judge O'Malley.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The case management system came about as a response to the Office of Legislative Auditor's audit a few years ago, in which, as the Assistant Commissioner mentioned, the goal is to speed up the resolution process for disputes in workers' comp so that injured workers and employers, medical providers, and so on can have certainty and move these cases along faster. As part of that, all these changes have been recommended. The case management system, when it was recommended that we look at that, the Office of Administrative Hearings worked with the Office of Enterprise Technology, OET, and we got a consultant to come in, reviewed our process and reviewed our computer system, checked with tribunals around the country, and came up with a recommendation based on their assessment that a new case management system would be necessary for really two reasons. One, to move these improvements along, and then secondly, our current system is really not vendor supported anymore. It's inevitable that we need to do something. And this was an opportunity to accomplish both of those at the same time.
Thank you. And this directly addresses the fiscal note, of course. And I'm understanding that the $600,000 is to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and it is coming. I have a couple of questions about it because the effective date for the bill is August 1st, and when we do appropriations, they usually start with the new fiscal year on July 1st, and I'm wondering if there is a reason why we would have August 1st in here.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, August 1st was selected so that these changes that need to take place, we would have time to transition into them. For example, the having one judge hear the conference at the beginning of the case and a separate judge handle the formal hearing, that's not the way it's done now, and we've already scheduled out 3 months or so. We've been working with Department of Labor and Industry, with the bar, and others to try and come up with a plan to implement that so that it'll be smoother and no cases get delayed. So that's why we picked August 1st. As far as the case management system, in working with the Office of Enterprise Technology and MMB, we have an RFP that is being worked on that is close to completion. If the funding's approved, we could move that process forward, but we wouldn't be in a position to actually select a vendor and start moving on the process until after August 1st, so that wouldn't delay us at all.
Okay, and then the other thing I was just wondering about, do you think you will have it completed within our fiscal cycle, or do you think that you would like some language indicating that the appropriation was available until expended? Or will it be all gone within 23 months after your start date?
We're confident it'll be done within 23 months. We're going to move this along because it's so important for us to be able to implement these changes. The case management system goes hand in hand with that. And we've done a lot of work over the last 2 years, really, since the Legislative Auditor's Report to assess this. And we have I should mention the $600,000 is really the maximum that could be. With the OET, the macro group that came in and did the study, came up with four or five vendors that could meet the requirements based on their study. And some of them were significantly less than that. But until we go through the RFP process and a vendor selected, we won't know what that cost would be.
Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Senator Chair. Madam Chair, I mentioned that I had been involved in the workers' comp reform years back. This is a result of the workers' comp reform. And it is so much better for legislators to have this worked out and then come to the legislature. Because otherwise there's winners and losers and everything. So this I think, was a very excellent outcome of that reform. And I just really appreciate it as a legislator.
Senator Goodwin.
I wanted to just echo that because, I've attended meetings in the past of the Workers' Comp Council, and I think it's a real model for what could be done in other legislation that comes before us where business and labor can work things out, or labor and environmentalists or whatever, before we have to have these huge battles down here. So I just want to say that everybody that I've known that, and I haven't known everybody that served on it, but those that I've known that have served on it, have done a really good job, business and labor, of working things out so we don't have the major battles we had in the 80s and 90s, and that's huge.
Senator Higgins?
I'll three it. I served on the Workers' Comp Council some number of years back, and it was fascinating to watch how the two sides kind of worked together. And there were a lot of proposals where, after the discussion, the proposal did not get a majority of votes on both labor side and industry side, and then they moved on to the next thing. And it is a model to keep us from just mucking around in things that we don't really know enough about. And I'm glad that we came through with some recommendations.
Senator Perry?
I was just going to move the bill, Madam Chair.
If we're ready for that? Senator, is there any further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? If not, Senator Perry moves that Senate File 1159 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the floor for general orders. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders, and we will adjourn until Friday.
Thanks,
Senator. Thank you, members.